Hello everyone, welcome to Villa Together, the full 90 podcast. Reaction to Aston Villa 0, Burnley 0. Once again, I am joined by Ian Gillett and Joe Davidson. Fellas, how are you doing?
All good, Chris, all good.
Yeah, good as always, Chris.
I think we probably all got this, you know, similar kind of feeling in terms of a bit of frustration, disappointment off the back of last night's game. And I think one of the kind of things that stands out is the kind of the stats from the game. So 27 shots from Aston Villa, 7 on target. Joe, talk us through the game and how it kind of panned out.
Yeah, so I think it's no great mystery that we were the better team by a long, long way. Frankly, I thought Burnley were poor throughout. We dominated the ball. We made so many chances. It wasn't even funny. Luck just wasn't on our side, really. They had one chance, really, which was the Chris Wood header that Emi Martinez saved. I felt at the back, we dealt with them really well. They had very little threat going forward. The one breakaway, I remember Nakamba sold himself short in their half and they broke. And there was one other actually where Means did the same. But really, we didn't look in trouble at any point throughout. Midfield-wise, I felt we, again, dominated the ball, controlled it well. Nakamba did an okay job of stepping in for Douglas Luiz. Passing wasn't quite there in comparison, but you do expect that. The other one who stepped in, obviously being Elmo, right back, I felt he had a fairly solid game. Again, got caught a couple of times, but nothing major. The story of the game, though, was the lack of goals. 27 shots, no goals. It really is one of those. You felt that game could have gone on for 3-4 hours and we still wouldn't have scored. Sometimes it just isn't your day, and I think that was definitely the case.
Yeah, just before we kind of move on and look at our chances and kind of talk about the kind of look at the XG and stuff like that. Ian, we spoke last week about this game. We were aware of the changes that would be made, which would have been Cash and Douglas Luiz. There was also a late change, which was Ezri Konsa dropping out, Warmi Hawes coming in. Traore continued to play ahead of Trezeguet, who's got an injury, and Jacob Ramsey dropped to the bench. I think I noted at this, you know, before the game, there was a lot of kind of negativity around our team and our lineup, mainly because of, you know, the players that are missing, players that have come in. What did you think of the lineup in terms of, you know, seeing those changes? Was it what you expected, or was there a couple of surprises for you?
Yeah, for me, Chris, that was the expected lineup, albeit obviously the bombshell of Konsa dropping out. I don't know if it was during the day or they'd made the decision the night before, because Dean Smith has since gone on record to say that the illness came on Wednesday, didn't they? So I don't know if they knew about it previously. He's been tested for COVID. It's not coronavirus. So that was the only sort of real one that was the bombshell on the match day. And then, to be fair to House, he slotted in well and did a really good job. You know what you're going to get with Burnley. It's quite a direct physical form of football, and they like getting it forward to their big men quite quickly, and House dealt with everything brilliantly in the air. But yeah, looking at Nakamba, Joe said he did an okay job, steady job, nothing spectacular. I did think we missed Luiz's passing in the middle, and then Elmo was slotted in for Cash, and we said that, didn't we, in the post-match podcast after the Wolves game, that we fully expected it to be Elmo with Gilbert on the bench. So there was no real surprises for me, Chris, and it was the team that I would have gone with. I think Dean Smith made the right decision in putting Jacob Ramsey back on the bench, because it was all about that midfield for me last night, and it proved that we did create more than enough chances to win the game, and we had the lion's share of possession. I think it was 60% possession to us overall, and there wasn't any stages in the game, apart from one scare, maybe when Ashley Westwood had that chance that sort of they dominated the midfield. I thought we did really well in that middle three.
Yeah, I think just go over some of the stats. Yeah, 59% possession, so just under 60. Burnley's 41, 27 shots, 7 on target, as we said. Burnley, 6 shots, 4 on target. Pass success rate, 73%, Burnley 61. 19 dribbles to 6. 68 aerial duels won in favour of Burnley 62. 6 tackles to Burnley's 19. 10 corners to Burnley's 1. I think you kind of look at that. There's a couple of things that kind of stand out for me. And they were, we won more aerial duels than Burnley, which I think is a credit to those guys at the back, Mings and Courtney Hawes in particular, because, you like you say, you know what you're going to expect coming up against Burnley. So to have won that many headers and to have won more headers than Burnley just kind of shows that we did quite well. I think it's kind of, it's adding that bit of an edge, bit of an extra element to us that we probably didn't have last season. You know, it's that kind of bit of a know-how, extra bit of an edge in terms of we're getting up there, not being naive, winning those headers. The other one, pass success rate, 73%. I think that's slightly down on what our pass success rate was from the weekend. But the kind of the thing is as well, with having such a, you know, almost 60% possession, and only having a 73% pass success rate, you know, that possibly kind of links in with our kind of why we didn't score. You know, there, obviously, I know we had 27 shots, but there were times when, particularly in the second half going forward, we didn't quite make the right pass, or sometimes we were trying to force things. One thing I did notice as well was, and we were able to do it against Wolves, which was coming from the centre-half, so we know that Mings and Konza like the ball at feet. Being able to knock it into Douglas Luiz, for example, or Jack Grealish, we know he drops deep, John McGinn as well. Any of those midfield three, Jacob Ramsey obviously was in the centre, with Grealish dropping, you know, was on the left, this is in the Burnley game. Any of the midfield three will come to feet, and it gives us the opportunity to play it into them, and it kind of opens up a bit more space. So they will bring with them, you know, whether it's Grealish, McGinn, Ramsey, whoever, Barkley, when he was there, bring with them one of the opposition midfielders or one of the opposition centre-halves, depending on who they're marking. Now, last night, I noticed there's a lot of times Tyrone Mings in particular had the ball and he'd look 10, 15 yards in front of him was Marvellous Nakamba. Now, Nakamba, I think Joe said, had a decent game, but compared to Douglas Luiz, he's probably, you know, arguably within top 10, maybe top 5 kind of defensive midfield players in the league in terms of ticking all the boxes that you want in terms of, you know, ball winner and passing. It was, is good. I mentioned the other day, 100% pass success rate against Burnley for Douglas Luiz. So one thing that he was looking, Marvis Nakamba is there, but rather than lay it off to Nakamba, because he knows he's going to take a few more touches, he's getting the ball forward quickly. And that is bread and butter for a team like Burnley, because they can just win the headers and that's it, and get the ball forward. And I think there was a lot of that happening. I think that was another side of the game where things broke down and where we didn't kind of exploit Burnley enough, was that we weren't playing the short balls into the midfield to look at trying to create that space in the midfield or from the defence. And as well, obviously, you're going to expect Burnley to have more tackles. I'm surprised. I think there was actually only one yellow card for Burnley. Last night, which is quite surprising. I'm a bit baffled why Ben Mee didn't get booked. We know he's a bit of a dirty bastard. But just having a bit of a breakdown on the chances we had in the game. So we ended the game. Our XG was 1.81 against Burnley's 0.32. And Joe, again, it's another game where we've massively outperformed the opposition in terms of XG.
Yeah, absolutely. We were all over them. Although, with that being said, from 27 shots, a 1.8 XG isn't massive. And yeah, I think that is quite telling when we're talking about this lack of chance creation from the midfield, that actually quite a lot of those shots were relatively speculative, particularly El Ghazi just popping them off from left, right and centre. But yeah, I think there is a bit of a theme emerging at this stage that we do seem to be underperforming our XG at the moment. With that being said, most of the data from across other seasons will suggest that that will eventually level out and that we will eventually start performing at a closer rate. I'm not overly concerned. My biggest concern in a lot of ways is our players' heads dropping from not taking those chances. Like, end of the day, this happens to teams, it's happened to Man City, it's happened to Liverpool, it's happened to Chelsea, Arsenal, it happens to everyone. Eventually, you get a game where you dominate, you have shot after shot, and it just won't go in for you. What's important, though, is that we keep taking those shots, and when we get in those positions, we keep having a go. And I thought I saw the first sort of signs of that in that Burnley game with Traore trying to pass to Watkins. No idea why he did that. It was one-on-one with the keeper. It was bizarre.
Yeah.
El Ghazi looked a little bit sheepish towards the end, and I thought even Grealish did. And I think this is where confidence in football is such an important aspect, that we need to retain that sort of cocksure attitude that we can beat teams and that we are better than them. And as soon as our heads drop and we feel that, oh, it won't go in, that's when 9 times out of 10 you're right, and it happens. And I felt that at times we looked almost a little bit hurried to get the shot away. We looked a little bit like sort of sheep in the headlights when the chances were coming our way at points. And
yeah,
we need to get on top of that, I think. And the players as a whole just need to keep their heads on and understand that, yeah, this happens, but it will get right. It will go right eventually.
Yeah, I think it seemed to be that I think pretty much every chance we had, there was a real lack of conviction. Players were either, it was very in between. So there was no, you kind of, having a shot, you either want to put your foot through it and kind of try and trust the power and hope that it's going to hit the target, or you wrap your foot round it and you try and place it somewhere and hope that it beats the keeper. And sometimes it was just a bit either too much, you know, too central, not enough pace on it, or, you know, someone's tried to bend it round the corner, but it's gone too wide. We mentioned Ian last week about El Ghazi. Obviously, he hasn't played much this season, scored the winner against Wolves. We kind of expected that he might come into the team. What did you think of his performance last night?
I think his all-round performance last night was really good. I think he did everything right apart from score a goal. I mean, if he scores the free kick where Pope makes a brilliant save, touches onto the bar, we're all talking about El Ghazi like he's Cristiano Ronaldo, the second coming, aren't we? Because it was a great strike. There was a few times where Grealish got in between their lines and fed him. And it comes back to this the age-old sort of dynamic of having the wrong-footed player on the opposite wing, doesn't it? Because either time he's sort of hit it with his right foot and it's gone straight down Pope's neck and it's an easy collection for him. Whereas if you've got a left-footed player coming on to one of those opportunities, he's probably just going to drill it across the keeper into the bottom corner. And Traore, to be fair, had one exactly the same where he probably just waited a moment too long to take his strike. I think he was waiting for the ball to come down completely before he tried to hit it. And fair play to Burnley, because you know what they're going to do. They've got those two centre-backs and they are a great partnership. They put their bodies on the line for that club and they get the blocks in. But yeah, in terms of El Ghazi, I thought he did really well. I mean, if he'd taken one of those chances, it'd easily have been man of the match for me. And considering he hasn't played a lot of football, especially 90-minute matches, in the not-so-recent history, he did really well throughout the game, I thought. And he affected the game, which is what you want your wingers to do.
Yeah, I think you want to see that from your wingers. If he'd scored a goal, then, yeah, I think he'd have gone away with man of the match. And it's adding that. You want to see your wingers be confident. And I think we've mentioned it amongst ourselves, haven't we, the last few days, that Bertrand Traore, obviously, he's a talented guy. You know, he looks like a good technician, but hasn't done enough in terms of trying to commit defenders and run at defenders and trying to take them on. Whereas El Ghazi seemed to do that quite a bit. So I think confidence-wise looks quite good. And I think there certainly was something there. So, you know, I'd expect Trezeguet to kind of come in at some point because he's had a good season apart from, you know, scoring goals. If Jack Grealish, you know, Barker comes in, Grealish goes back to the left. So you could have, in Traore and El Ghazi, two players on the bench who, if we can kind of give them a bit of confidence, then better options come off the bench than possibly before. Just going to look at the, so as you mentioned, Joe, obviously 1.81 XG, 27 shots. It is fairly poor when you take that into consideration. You expect it to be quite a bit higher. So 7 shots on target. From the 27 shots, 9 of them were outside of the box. And the XG of those 9 shots varied between 0.01 and 0.05, with the 0.05 being the old Ghazi free kick. So I think that clearly reflects that those chances were pretty speculative. Yeah. And then you look at the remaining 18 that were in the box, the XG for them ranged from 0.02 to 0.34. So if your best chance being 0.34, which is a relatively decent chance, that was the Courtney Hawes header, which happened late in the first half. I think it's one of them. I think you mentioned it, Joe, having that bit of luck. Yeah. Obviously, that comes to him. It comes to him quickly, but you know, how many times do you kind of see people just, you know, bury that?
Well, I think luck is an irrefutable fact in football. I mean, we all like to go on about, oh, this player's a fantastic finisher, or this player puts away this many chances. But actually, what you normally find is, outside of a very elite few, most players finish around the same sort of rate. Today was just one of those days. Give Horse that header 10 times, probably 8 of them go in. It just happened that one was one of the two. And that was the story time and time again. Like, same with the El Ghazi free kick, same with probably even Bertrand Traore, the one where me and Tarkowski got across the block. Yeah. How many times have you seen two defenders slide in like that, eclipse off one and goes in? It was just, in a lot of ways, bad luck. I think we just have to carry on as we are going at the moment, because end of the day, we're making lots of chances. And that's the thing that you need to fall back on in these instances, is that we're still outplaying teams. We're still making chances left, right and centre. We look solid defensively. And when you compare where we are now to last season, going into a game with 5 of our first 11 missing and absolutely dominating, if we went into this game last season, we'd have been beaten 3-0.
Yeah, I think that's the key thing when you look at the players we had missing. Dean Smith mentioned it after the game, and 40% of the team missing. And I think really, if you look at the team and you look at the players missing, I think possibly based on form, after Jack Grealish and probably Emi Martinez, you might say the kind of most important players who you'd least want to be missing from the game would probably be Ross Barkley, Douglas Luiz, possibly Ezri Konsa.
I absolutely agree with that. I think we haven't just lost important players. We've lost pretty much the spine of our team outside of Grealish. Him and Mings are pretty much the two remaining at that point. And I think losing Douglas Luiz in a lot of ways was the most impactful of the bunch. He's the metronome in our team. He dictates the pace of play. And I think losing him was partly what allowed Burnley to fill their box as well as they did, because we didn't have anyone to up the tempo. And again, I feel that without Douglas Luiz and particularly Barkley in the team, you lead to your main striker, in this case Watkins, being very isolated. And I definitely think that was a problem yesterday.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of... and to be fair, you're one of the first people to kind of jump on these guys on social media, notably on Facebook, where people make kind of rubbish, inaccurate claims about players. And I've seen a lot about Ollie Watkins. Ollie Watkins, is he all that? Ollie Watkins, you know, £30 million of rubbish and all this kind of stuff. What did you make about his performance last night?
So I'm just going to come out and say that anyone who's claiming Ollie Watkins isn't a good striker is talking utter bollocks. It's just plainly untrue. So I'll firstly address the idea that he's actually a winger and not a striker. So bear in mind, we've all spoken about a good target man who can link play. I think it's fair to say the one in the Premier League at the moment who is sort of the standout is Raul Jimenez. I think that's a fair statement. He's the one people normally go to. So Ollie Watkins is winning a higher percentage of aerial duels than him. He's winning a higher percentage of the duels on the ground. He's got a better passing rate, and he's got a better dribbling rate. that there isn't really much question there. Oh, and he's hitting the target with more of his chances and has a better shot conversion. He's literally outperforming him in virtually every aspect.
I think one thing that is kind of a bit more of a, you know, just for people who are watching games, is something to kind of, I suppose, as a yardstick for Ollie Watkins, is when you compare him to Ali Samata being the main one, there were numerous games last season with Ali Samata where you literally would be, you know, you'd be pressed to think of something notable that he'd done in the game. And by notable, I mean a touch that he'd made in the game. Quite often, Samata was, you know, was playing, but just literally doing nothing. Whereas, you know, when, you know, Watkins tried, it's one of them people say, why is Watkins, what's he doing on the left wing and stuff like that? But better strikers don't just stand in one place, because if, especially up against Ben Mee and James Tarkowski, if Ollie Watkins is going to stand centrally, it's easy for them. Yeah. If he drifts out wide, we've got an opportunity then to try and disrupt their defence. But as you say, you know, he's all-round game. So far this season has been fantastic.
Yeah, the role of a lone striker has changed in the last 15 years. The days of Didier Drogba standing up front on his own and just standing in front of the centre-backs is long gone. Defenders are too sharp and too quick for it now. They will put one in front of you, one stands behind, so then they just absolutely cover any flick on and you get nowhere doing it. It's essentially what Wesley tried to do last year and we couldn't get the ball to him. Watkins pulling wide, in effect, forces the centre-backs to come with him, at least one of them. And then that opens up the space for Grealish and whoever is playing on the right wing to run into. If they're not running into that space, that's their problem. That's not Watkins' fault. And I think that's where a lot of people get a bit sort of confused by it. But yes, he's there primarily to be getting on the end of chances. But at the same time, his movement around the defence is such a key aspect. And that's a massive part of why we bought him. Because we didn't want someone who would just stand up front for the whole game doing nothing.
Yeah, like you say, it's that the roles change so much. You can't get away with doing that. You can't get away with standing up front and waiting for a chance to come and put it away. I feel like Samata in particular was someone who certainly did that. Wesley had his, you know, in all fairness, had moments where he did that. If you look at, you know, just look at just some basic stats. 11 games played, he scored 6 goals. So, you know, he's already just better than a 1-in-2 man, which, you know, for a season and his first season in the Premier League, that's all you can ask for, you know, as a centre forward. You know, he's got an assist to his name. His passing accuracy, is pretty good. You know, it's over 70% per game. So again, as a striker, he's impacting in that way. What's also quite good is, as you've said, you've mentioned about Raúl Jiménez and the dribbles. You know, 75% of his dribbles are successful. And I think we can see that at times when he gets into the channels and he starts running at teams. And that's hard to defend against. And I think what's been good from him and good for us is that at times when we're going from defence to attack, it's not just Grealish that we're relying on to carry the ball. We've got another ball carrier in, obviously, Ross Barkley. But Ollie Watkins is certainly one who can do it. And he did it last night at times. It's just, I think it's unfortunate because people will say, as I have seen them say, well, we've created 27 shots, you know, why hasn't Watkins scored? If he's a good striker, he gets himself in the right positions. But like you said at the start, the number of speculative chances we had, and which is, in all fairness, reflected by our XG, it's one of them people who've got to start thinking before they speak and slay him, who's probably our best, I say since Tammy Abraham, which has only been a couple of seasons, but he's certainly our best striker since Tammy Abraham.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when you consider the performances Watkins is putting in so far at a much higher level, I think it would probably be safe to say he's actually a better striker than Tammy Abraham. Probably the last comparable sort of level striker is going to be Benteke. I mean, I'm not sure Watkins will score quite as many, but I think his overall impact on build-up play and his ability to bring others into the game is certainly as good as. And frankly, he's doing what's been asked of him. If they wanted him to stand up front, I'm sure he would do that. He's been asked to drift. He's been asked to try and pull into these pockets of space, and he's doing exactly what we need him to do. If he was suffering that badly, we wouldn't be winning games.
Yeah, just to kind of look at just a quick comparison, Ollie Watkins, obviously 25 league goals last season for Brentford, which is why we splashed the cash on him. You look at the a few of the things. So you're looking at shots per game. He was averaging 2.6 shots per game for Brentford last season. He's averaging 2.7 shots per game for us this season. So it's around the same margin, better for us. Key passes, 1.6 key passes last season for Brentford, 1.8 key passes for us this season, 0.8 dribbles per game for Brentford last season, 1.5 dribbles per game for us this season. So just those kind of things. I think obviously a big part of that is the style of play. We know from watching the occasional game last season and looking at the stats, which in episode 2, you mentioned about Ollie Watkins and stuff like that. And there were a lot of times when it was a case of Ollie Watkins was central and he was in the right place at the right time when you got the likes of Mbeumo and Benrahma getting the ball into him. But just looking at those kind of stats, yep, certainly encouraging for him going forward.
Yeah, definitely. I think the one criticism that, again, has been aimed at him a little bit, that he's not in the right spaces, I would completely disagree with. He's shown on a number of occasions this season that if the ball is played into him, he is in the right spots. The West Ham goal that was disallowed, prime example, same as the header against Liverpool, same as the goals against Arsenal. He's absolutely making those runs. I think when we've lost Barkley, we've lost essentially another set of eyes who's capable of actually picking him out. Now we've only got Grealish, and Grealish is having to do the work of two. It just makes it that much harder to get the ball into him. And I think as soon as Barkley comes back, we'll be absolutely fine. This is exactly what we spoke about, though, actually, prior to the season starting, regarding transfers as well, that we really needed a right winger who could do this role as well. I still feel we are really lacking that. Trezeguet's work rate is fantastic, and I think he's sort of Dirk Kuyt-esque, isn't he? Perhaps not the most technical player, but he just works so hard, and there's a massive amount of value in that. But I do think against a team like Burnley, if Traore could put up sort of similar numbers to what Barkley was doing, what Grealish is doing, I think that would make a huge difference. And potentially that's where we should be looking come January, come next season, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I certainly agree. And I'm sure in a couple of weeks, the Rashica rumour is going to rear its ugly head. A move that I would be delighted to see. Just going to move on to a player that hasn't really featured much since the first few weeks of the season. That's Conor Hourihan. Ian, are you surprised that since, obviously, when it comes to it, and you have a decision that is Barkley or Hourihan, you're always going to go with Ross Barkley. But in the last is it 3-4 games since Barkley's been injured, Hourihan's only made one start. Are you surprised at that?
I was a little surprised, if I'm honest. I thought Smith would sort of default back to Conor Hourihan and put the trust in him. But I think it just describes the sort of the way we were trying to move forward in terms of how we dominate games at the moment. And when you have a player like Conor Hourihan in, you predominantly got him in there for his set pieces and his passing ability. But he doesn't really affect games in terms of playing through the lines and transitioning play that well. And he's not the fastest of players in the midfield, especially when you're playing a three and you're holding midfielder is either Douglas Luiz or, like we saw last night, Nakamba. And then you want your other two to be doing a lot of running. When without the ball, you want them to have that defensive structure. And I think for long periods of games, Hourihan can go missing, which is ultimately his biggest downfall. So I haven't been surprised that Smith is trying to change the way that we sort of direct our approach play going forward. And like we saw against Wolves with Jacob Ramsey coming in, it was a steady game for Jacob, but he has got that ability to turn on the half turn and transition you from defence to attack quite quickly, which Conor Hourihan doesn't have for me, because he'll just play it off the simple, or he'll try and thread it through to somebody. But yeah, it's going to be interesting to see going forward now with hopefully Barkley being back. I don't know if the Baggies game is going to be too early for him. If I know Smith said he didn't want to risk having him picking up another injury on his hamstring. So we might see him on the bench, but it'll be interesting to see what he goes with for the Baggies game, because now we're looking at it and we really want to get maximum points out of that going into the festive period with sort of Chelsea, Crystal Palace and Man United to come.
Yeah, I think I'm really hoping that Barkley, whether it's a case of, do you know what, we want, you know, whether Dean Smith and the guys kind of thought, you know, we want Barkley to play against West Brom. Let's, you know, because we don't want to risk it at all. Let's kind of keep him fresh, not put him on the bench. Let's keep him. I suppose part of me thinks he's a bit off, you know, bit off being fit because he wasn't on the bench. But then part of me also thinks, well, maybe because if he is on the bench, then there's the risk that if he warms up, or the risk that because he's on the bench, they think, oh, let's go to Ross Barkley. He's a good player. That's why they haven't put him on there. But we'll see. I think a lot of people have mentioned about Hal Rahan, and you kind of think, you know, he came in the first game that Ross Barkley was injured. Was that West Ham game? Was he started the West Ham game? Was it? Yeah, because Traore came on for Barkley, didn't he, when he got injured? I think the thing is with Hal Rahan is that when you look at our midfield, if you include all of them, so Jack Grealish, Ross Barkley, they're more number 10s. They obviously can play 8. John McGinn is a bit of a box-to-box midfielder, more of an 8 than a 6. Then you've got Luiz and Marlis Nakamba, who are, you know, defensive midfielders, probably, you know, 2 number 6s. And you look at kind of Hal Rahan, I'm kind of thinking, I'm not entirely sure where he fits in, what his best position is. So I've looked at the kind of the key stats around centre midfielders. So this is based on last season. So you're looking at tackles. So this is tackles across the season. So in 46 appearances, last season coming to this season, 46 appearances. Luiz made 55 tackles. Nakamba 56 in 33. Harahan 16 in 31. So he falls quite a bit lower than the others. If you look at passes, so passes per game, again, this is since the start of last season. Jack Grealish 30.42, Ross Barkley 39.43, Douglas Luiz 35.41, Marvellous Nakamba 24.82 passes per game, Connor Harahan 24.03, and then interceptions. So just look at interceptions against Douglas Luiz and Marvellous Nakamba. Douglas Luiz 49 interceptions, Marvellous Nakamba 40 interceptions, Connor Harahan 9 interceptions. And I think you kind of look at, I suppose, passing, tackling and interceptions in terms of, we know Ross Barkley's not a dynamic centre midfielder. He's not a Barkley, Grealish, a John McGinn. And I suppose you could say, okay, if you stick him in there, he's got good technical abilities. He sits there. But then his kind of passing numbers don't reflect someone who you'd want to be as a sitting midfielder. And I suppose if you sit in, you've got to break up play, and his tackles and interceptions, again, don't reflect what you'd expect of someone who's a sitting midfielder. Does this kind of go back to support your point, Joe, when you said about Hal Rahan going missing?
I've got to be honest, those stats are worse than I thought they'd be. They're pretty shocking, actually, when you hear them.
Yeah.
And it does completely fit the narrative that Hurahan's there for his free kicks and his corners. At this level, you can't just have someone in the team to take free kicks and corners. You just can't. And having a midfielder who's being bypassed that easily is really, really poor. Unfortunately, it's a similar sort of issue that Chelsea had with Jorginho when he was playing. But yeah, and to be fair, Jorginho is a far better passer than Hurahan is. Hurahan passes at around an 86% rate. But if he was passing at like a 95 with massive, massive numbers of decisive passes and things, you might be able to make an argument for it. But he isn't. He's a fairly decent passer of the ball, but a very, to be honest, a poor defensive midfielder. And he lacks the physicality and the dynamicism to play there, really. I just don't think there's really much argument to make for him. And it's a real shame because I really like him. He's always come across as a really nice bloke. And I think as part of the squad as a whole, he's a positive thing to have. But I just think, is he really going to add much value at this stage? And I don't think he really does.
Yeah, I think he probably is one of the few players who's, I think, you know, universally liked by all Villa fans. You know, aside from the fact that some people won't want him in the squad, in the team, some will want him in the team, but people do, I think, like him as a bloke and probably respect what he's done for us over the last few seasons. You know, obviously big goals for us when we got promoted against West Brom in the home leg of the semi-final. But yeah, like you say, when I went through those stats, I had to double check them because I knew they were low. I think I can't think who it was, someone put on Twitter last year, they kind of said, you know, to support why Conor Halloran's not playing, I've looked at how he fares in terms of tackles and interceptions, which is a key part of a midfielder's game. Certainly, you know, if you're away from a number 10, I suppose, certainly a 6 or an 8, you'd want them to be at least making the tackles or kind of making interceptions. I think, you know, regardless of tackle success rate, if you're only making, you know, 16 tackles, you know, across a season, you know, it's pretty shocking when you've got Luiz and Nakamba. Nakamba played 2 more games and he almost, you know, he pretty much trebled the amount of tackles that he made, that Halloran made. So I think, you know, people kind of think, well, Halloran, we need him for his set pieces. And I kind of, you know, is that part of the reason with Traore coming in? Because he seems to be the main man on the free kicks at the moment in terms of getting them in the box. And in all fairness, has shown some quality from putting them in. He got an assist against Brighton, whipping them in with his left foot.
Yep. Yep. And he was very unlucky to not get another one for Wolves yesterday. I absolutely think that was a big part in why we've gone with Traore, frankly. We needed a set-piece specialist, and he's one. He's got a lot of direct free kicks in his career. He's very good from corners. It's just, as I mean, we've been fairly critical of him on here, I think fairly justifiably so far. But if you can bring the rest of his game up to his set piece delivery, then we can have a very, very good player there.
Yeah, yeah. I agree. It's a tough one. We mentioned it last week, didn't we, Ian, about you've got to allow players time to settle in. The two kind of perfect examples are Trezeguet, Douglas Luiz, who at the start of last season were relatively poor. And then arguably, you know, post-lockdown, Trezeguet and Douglas Luiz were, you know, you've got one who was a match winner in 2 games. And Douglas Luiz was arguably our best player post-lockdown. So, you know, it's key to give these players time.
Yeah, I think I think Traore is at least probably 6 months of put consistent Premier League play away from being able to show his best form.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. I mean, last night it was frustrating creating that many chances. You kind of think how many times was Nick Pope really tested, like properly tested at full stretch? And I don't think I can't really think of one off the top of my head in all fairness. You know, who would you, looking at the game, who would you be saying would have been your man of the match, Ian?
I'll stick to what I said earlier. I think Al Ghazi would have been my man of the match, regardless of his finishing. Other mentions, Jack Grealish again. Second half came on a lot. I thought he was a bit, I don't know what the word is to describe his performance in the first half. I think he was coming like the Jack of old, where he wanted to affect the game and have his stamp, make his mark on the game. So he was coming a little bit deeper. And because we didn't have Douglas Luiz in that midfield with his ability on the ball and his passing range, you're looking for Nakamba to sort of help you transition from attack to defence. And it's never going to happen with a player like Marvellous, is it? So Jack was coming a little bit deeper, and because he had that free roll in that 10 position, he was coming and collecting the ball a little bit deeper in the first half. But second half, he was getting in between the lines again, and he tried to recreate, I think it was about the 90th minute when he tried to recreate the goal he scored against Burnley last season away at Turf Moor. You could see he tried to put it in that top corner again, didn't they? That top left-hand corner as you look at the goal. And he probably should have just opened his body up and slotted it in the corner. But yeah, it was Anwar El Ghazi for me, and then closely followed by Jeff.
Who would you have said for last night, Joe?
I've got something I want to say before we get to that, but someone who I think deserves a bit of a mention, who again has taken such a amount of flack on social media recently, Tyron Mings. He's not my man of the match, but I think, again, he's been consistently very good. There's been all sorts of calls to drop him and whatever else. I think it's absolute lunacy, frankly. Yes, he is prone to the odd error, but I think it's fairly evident he's been asked to try and break that initial press by Dean Smith. And frankly, I think the quality he brings far outweighs the occasional errors. And that was just one that I really think needs mentioning, considering how many people seem to be having a pop at him recently. In terms of yesterday's game, I'm actually going to go against you on this one, Ian. I felt that El Ghazi, he had a few sort of showy moments. And if that free kick had gone in, I think we would, as you say, be singing a very different tune. But for me, I felt he ignored Watkins and Grealish's runs quite a lot. I felt he was a bit greedy at times, and I felt his finishing was really, really poor. He's the most frustrating player in our squad for me. He's got these flashes of brilliance, and then he just absolutely flops it at the end, and he does it so often. Out of all the players in our squad, he's the one that I think I want to come right more than anyone else. But for me, man of the match is going to be Jack Grealish, I think. He had a very different game to how he normally plays on the left wing these days, having to drop quite a lot deeper. He was essentially playing Barkley's role, really. I felt he dictated play well. He probably should have had two or three assists, really, from slotting in both El Ghazi and Traore. He looked a frustrated figure by the end, and I think that shot he blazed over the bar was just symptomatic of that, really. But yeah, I think overall he was definitely our best player.
I think just a quick look at Grealish's stats: 76 touches, 43 accurate passes, which was just under a 96% passing accuracy, which I think, you know, pretty brilliant for Grealish. Not saying his passing tends to be poor, but he's certainly a guy that rarely passes backwards. He passes forwards, you know, quite often, takes a lot of risks as well. So posting that passing accuracy is pretty good. 6 key passes, you know, which was really good. 3 shots off target, 3 shots blocked. 5 dribbles attempted, 4 successful. Ground jewels as well. We know he's a strong guy. 12 successful from 17. And I think, you know, you could see that a lot, the way he was just nicking the ball off players and getting stuck in. And I think he was, it's one of them, a lot of people, it does make a difference being on the left to being on the right. I think sometimes there is, he's never going to get forgotten, but I think with him being out wide, the concentration is not 100% look on the winger as opposed to a number 10. And I think as well, if you're a number 10, you're more likely to get picked up by the kind of the centre-halves, the big guys. And that's, you know, it's fine. Jack Grealish could get past those guys. But, as Ben Mee showed last night, if you try and get past me, I'll kick you up in the air. I was thinking, coming in off the left, it's very different as well with the balls coming in. It's different. Sometimes you want him centrally, sometimes you want him out wide. You know, he can play either, and he can play either brilliant. And he showed it last night. People kind of said, oh, Grealish wasn't his best in terms of, you know, people were saying that he was poor. But obviously, looking at those stats, posted some pretty good stats. Just quickly going to your point you mentioned, Joe, about Tyrone Mings. I think we'll all agree he makes the odd mistake. I feel like he plays in the right way. And I think people were saying, they mentioned it last night on the kind of the match commentary and stuff like that, which I thought was brilliant for Amazon Prime, to be honest. They mentioned about Tyrone Mings and about, obviously, at the moment, because of the COVID situation, no fans in the ground, so they can hear him more and hear him talking all the time, stuff like that. And I think he's essentially our leader on the pitch, isn't he? Last season, he picked up an injury and missed 4 games. It was pretty much 5. He went off after 23 minutes against Leicester, who beat us 4-1. I think he went off and it was 2-1 at the time. The 4 games after the Leicester game were Sheffield United, Southampton, Norwich and Watford. So realistically, at that time as well, Southampton were not particularly in great form. And we lost 3 of those four games, winning only one against Norwich, who were the worst team in the league. So then that, you know, kind of reflects the importance of him. People will say, get Mings out, get Hawes in, or Engels, whoever it may be, but you miss that leadership at the back. And I think that's certainly key for us. And in all fairness, you know, Ezri Konsa, we'll all agree, certainly post-lockdown, has been fantastic for us. But as a big part of that being down to Tyrone Mings, I think as a centre-half, coming through the game, at a young age, apart from the, you know, the top, top centre-halves, there's not a lot of kind of, as an English centre-half, a young English centre-half, I don't think there's a lot of better centre-halves to kind of come and play alongside, you know, than Tyrone Mings in terms of developing your game, just to bring that confidence out of you. To have that, you know, when you start playing football, if you're a centre-half, you want someone talking to you, and he's going to do that. So, you know, I agree with you, Joe. I think he's massively, massively important, and I just love the bloke, and he's got great abs. So, what's not to like?
I genuinely think he might be, at this stage, the most underrated player in our team. Like, I've seen people coming out and saying that he's not a proper leader, because I can't even understand the reasoning behind saying that. He's the most vocal on the pitch. He organises everything fantastically well. Since been in, we've kept 6 clean sheets this season from 11 games.
Yeah.
If that's not a leader, I don't know what is. And again, people love every time any little mistake from him. It's you know all the stuff on social media. It's absolutely ludicrous. But then Konsa slices one straight up in the air against Wolves and basically plays in one of their strikers. Absolute cricket. You don't hear a word about that. I just think as fans at times, we need to get away from the ideas we hold about players before games and use those to beat them with like a stick, because it's just silly that every little thing is the same with targets. Well, any tiny mistake and everyone has a go at him, as were if it's Matty Cash or if it's John McGinn, not a word.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I totally agree. I think as well, I think a big part of it is the way he plays his game. You know, he doesn't have to pass the ball around. You know, he doesn't have to try and, you know, because if you look at other centre-halves, not just for us, but at other clubs, they will just launch the ball forward. And I know Mings does that occasionally, but I think if you watch him, his first thought a lot of the time is to pass the ball, to look at, you know, Douglas Luiz, John McGinn, Target, Konsa. He's trying to play that pass. And I think, obviously, if you're passing it around a bit more as a defender, then your percentages in terms of the likelihood of making a mistake will go up. And I think that's the case for Tyrone Mings. He's 6'5". He's relatively quick. I mean, like I said, they reiterated the point last night. He's a late comer to the game. There probably are going to be parts of his game that, in terms of going up through the leagues as opposed to developing at an academy, that may be different and probably aren't as developed or as polished as other teams. But in all fairness, it's probably last season was probably his first kind of full season in the Premier League. You know, he had his injuries troubles at Bournemouth. I know I've just said the other thing. He missed 5 games last season. There was those 4 that I mentioned. He was missing from the Spurs game, the last home game before lockdown. 5 games, you know, it's pretty much a full season for him. You've got to take into consideration the, you know, what comes with that in playing a full season, the experience that comes with it. But I totally agree with you, Joe. I can't say a bad word about the bloke. You know, I think John McGinn is someone who's probably making more mistakes than most at the moment. But people do kind of, you know, I'm not saying I don't, but people do kind of like John McGinn. You know, he's almost can't do anything wrong, in all fairness. But just very quickly, going to move on to Sunday's game. Obviously, Bilic is gone. Allardyce is in. It's a tough one to work out whether their style of play is going to change much. You can draw a lot of similarities from our game last night to West Brom's last game against Man City. I think Man City had 26 shots at goal. I think they had 7 on target. Struggled to break down a resolute West Brom defence. And they ended up drawing 1-1. Good point. Obviously, we drew 0-0 last night despite dominating. Obviously, Man City dominated against West Brom. West Brom have kind of gone between this 3 at the back, so kind of a 5-4-1 or a 5-3-2 with the wing backs, or occasionally, you know, a kind of a more traditional 4-3-3 this season. You know, Sam Allardyce has been out of the game for almost 2 years now. He's a relatively decent coach. He's a relatively decent manager in terms of getting the most out of his players. How do you see West Brom lining up in terms of their shape, Ian? Do you think they're going to change it much?
I can't see with the short turnaround that Sam Allardyce has had to work with the players. I think yesterday would have been him all about just getting to know the players and talking about his ideas, what he wants to see for the remainder of the season. So I fully reckon he'll go with the same starting lineup that started against Man City. I think it will be a case of trying to frustrate us again and making sure we can't get our key players on the ball, the likes of Grealish, the two wingers, and getting Ollie Watkins into good positions. And like Sam, he's not renowned for his nice brand of tiki-taka football, is he? He's very much direct, get the ball in areas that can hurt teams. Your corners, your set pieces, we're gonna have to be totally switched on because you know what's going to come from a Sam Allardyce team in that form. They're probably going to make the game as scrappy and as dirty as possible. I think that was the case with Burnley last night. There was a lot of times where the ball went out of play, and every time the ball goes out of play, there's probably 30 to 40 seconds lost out of the 90 minutes because they take so long to get it back in. And I think that's going to be the case against Albion again. But they've still got good players, the likes of Dean Garda. Gallagher's been really impressive for me in a struggling team in the midfield, the player on loan. And it's going to be interesting, that midfield battle, because I think they play a three with Sawyers sort of sitting in that holding role. They mentioned it last night, actually, that on Wednesday, that he does make a lot of fouls within that, like, that last third of the pitch in the danger zones. So if we can make the most of set pieces that we could potentially get, then we should be able to sort of hopefully come away with maximum points. But don't get me wrong, it's going to be a tough game, and there's never any easy games against teams with new managers. There is that new manager bounce, and everybody's going to be wanting to impress Sam Allardyce to remain in that team for the rest of the season. What are your thoughts?
It's a tough one to work out. Just looking at Sam Allardyce and Everton, his first game, so Everton obviously last team aged, his first game was the 2nd of December 2017, so we're looking at 3 years. Came in with an easy home game against Huddersfield, and they got a 2-0 win. The previous game before that, Everton had actually won 4-0 against West Ham. But the game before that was where change of manager had kind of was made, with Southampton battering them 4-1. I suppose with Allardyce, he's quite traditional, and the way West Brom have lined up has been fairly traditional. I think one thing I'm unsure about at the moment is, I suppose a big thing as well is going to be Barkley coming in. How do you see us lining up for the game, Joe?
I imagine it will be relatively similar to what we played yesterday, to be honest. I can't see, unless Barkley's back, I think we'll stick pretty much to what it was then. On the note of that West Brom change as well, I just think it's worth saying that I think it's an absolutely disgraceful change. They've done, and I've seen so many neutrals say that they hope they go down for it. And to be honest, I like having Midlands teams in the league. I'm probably one of few Villa fans who would rather they stayed up, but I really would. But considering the way they've treated him, they fully deserve to go now. Like, it's everything wrong with modern football, in my opinion, and everything wrong with the way managers are treated currently. I feel like Sam Allardyce, he's one of those managers, isn't he? He's a Steve Bruce. He's one of those that they turn to every time things are looking a bit iffy. I don't think he offers anything, really. He hasn't even been a manager for 2 years. Like, I just don't understand it at all. All I can assume is that they're going to save some money. It's the only thing that makes any sense. But yeah, I think we'll set up pretty similarly, potentially with Barkley coming in that centre attacking mid role with Grealish moving back to the left. That would be what I think I would do. I think I'd probably stick with Traoré on the right unless we can have Trezeguet back. Obviously, Cash, Konsa, and Douglas Luiz will come back in.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of them, isn't it? I suppose with the, if you have, which I haven't seen it much with Trezeguet, I think with El Ghazi being one of the wingers, I feel like the El Ghazi, Traoré, Grealish kind of, you know, midfield three behind Watkins is a bit more of a fluid three than if Trezeguet is there. I think Trezeguet kind of sticks to his job is getting down the wing, getting down the channel, which obviously is, you know, it's a key thing, you key part of the game. It's kind of it's an important component that he adds to the game. Is the, you know, especially with Traoré not doing that and not running at players, it's certainly something that we tend to miss. But I do feel that the fluidity is there, and I think with having that fluid midfield three, I'd like to see, because I imagine West Brom, I know they're going to be at home and they're going to be fairly resolute, you know, especially when, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I think Jack Grealish is arguably, you know, top three best players in the league at the moment. There's a lot, you know, there's a lot of guys that I think, you know, you talk about the likes of Sterling and players at Man City, I think they're underperforming. Even Liverpool, you know, credit to them, top of the league. I think even Liverpool, you know, some of their players aren't quite firing on all cylinders. You know, possibly Salah. But yeah, I think Grealish is up there certainly at the moment. I think, you know, as Villa fans, we can see that his form from last season, he's just gone up leaps and bounds. And I think, you know, playing in it, playing for England has kind of, I suppose it's given him that taste, hasn't it, for international football, and he doesn't want to let it go. So there is that part of me that wants to see that kind of that three beyond Watkins and see it and us be a bit more fluid to then have that bit more of an attacking edge against West Brom. But I'd love to see Trezeguet come back. Whether he does, I think it's highly doubtful because he probably hasn't trained. Obviously, Barkley coming back would be fantastic. I imagine, yeah, there is the hope that they didn't risk him at all last night because they want him fit for the West Brom game. I think just having those, as you said, those three, Luiz, Cash and Konsa, having those three back, I think would be massive because they are three very, very good players and, you know, three of our form players this season, in all fairness. I don't know if Pereira is still suspended for West Brom.
He is, yeah. No,
is it his last? Is it his last one?
I think it is, yeah.
Yeah, so I imagine, I reckon they probably would, and part of this is probably going to be because A, they had a decent result, and B, because Allardyce has had so little time with the squad, they probably would line up similar to how they did against Man City, which would be that kind of that 5-3-2 with the wing backs, which I think they had Matt Phillips on the left side. I can't think of that one.
Who was it up front?
Robinson and Grant.
And Grant, yes, because Grant missed a pretty good chance, I believe. I think they'll stick relatively similar. I don't think Allardyce has had time to turn them into a 4-4-2 team yet. Give a couple of weeks.
Yeah, a couple of weeks. Enough games around Christmas for him to get stuck in.
Oh, it will be bedded in no time. One thing worth mentioning as well is that there was a lot of talk about the players being very, very unhappy about Billick being sacked. And I think it'll be very interesting to see the performances from them at the weekend, because historically when teams have sacked managers and the players haven't agreed, it doesn't tend to work out too well. But we will see.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because you kind of look at it first and foremost. You know, it's their job. They get paid handsomely to play football. But in football, especially these days, it's very important to have those relationships, good relationships with a manager. And obviously, you know, Bilic has got them promoted. I think, you know, you can kind of see, especially after the game the other night, they had a good relationship with him. So then to see him sacked, it might be, you know, they might be pretty pissed off. And think, do you know what? Fuck off. You know, if you're going to make decisions like that, then... And it just might be, I'm not saying that they're going to intentionally go out and play shit, but, you know, it's just that kind of in the back of their mind thing, you know, being pretty pissed off. And it might be something that clouds their judgment, who knows. But yeah, because as you say, you know, you've seen it, there's been times, haven't there, not just in the Premier League, but across one of the top four divisions where managers have been sacked. It's been a bit of a surprise. I mean, you look at Gary Monk at Birmingham City when they were in the playoffs. I think it's probably the last time they were even in the playoffs, let alone finishing in the playoffs, but they were in the playoffs, and he was having a good season. They sacked him and they kind of tailed off massively, and a lot of their players were pretty pissed off with that. So, yeah, certainly something worth remembering. What are your thoughts? Just give us a prediction on the game. I think probably going to be certainly a bit tougher because we're the away side, but how do you think we'll get on?
I think we'll win it, to be honest. I think with Allardyce coming in, there's every chance that that's going to have a negative impact, particularly on their attacking players like Dean Garner. Obviously, there's no Pereira. Defensively, I don't think they're as well put together as that Man City game would suggest. Previously, they've looked a bit shaky, particularly a good example being throwing away 3-0 lead against Chelsea, which could have been a loss quite easily as well. I'm going to predict 2-0 to us.
Yeah, it's a tough one. I'm sure this one's going to go. I mean, someone, I think, heard it earlier about our recent form at the Hawthorns. Obviously, our last game was the second leg of the semi-final last season. We lost 1-0. Time before that, it was the 2-2 draw with a Joe Rodriguez handball. Then the last time, and that was the last time we met in the Premier League, which was January 2016, the Hawthorns 0-0. Time before that, at the Hawthorns, was December 2014, where West Brom beat us 1-0. So in terms of the last time we beat them at the Hawthorns, we are going back to 2008.
Yeah, that's a good trip down memory lane there. But at the same time, what was the last time we beat Liverpool at home? What was the last time we beat?
Exactly.
It's been a long time since we beat quite a number of the teams we've beaten this season. So I think this year we're a very good team, and at the end of the day, quite a number of our players have probably never even played West Brom before, at least in the last couple of years.
Yeah. I think I don't think we've beaten Arsenal since 2013. And obviously we battered them last time we played them. So, you know, these records are there to be broken. I'm just going to go back to that. So the last time we beat West Brom, 2008. I want you to name our two strikers who happen to be our two goal scorers then. Who are our two strikers in that game?
Oh, wait. So it's going to be a Bonlaw. I'm really open to Bonlaw. It's either going to be Heskey or Carew. I'm going to go Heskey.
It was John Carew.
Oh, no.
Goals from John Carew and Gabby Bonlahor. Just a stab in the dark at who got the goal for West Brom.
Odin Wingy.
No, I don't think he was in the squad. No, it was James Morrison.
Fair enough. Yeah, he was there for absolutely ages.
Yeah.
Any chance for a free kick?
Doesn't say. There's nothing about it being a penalty, so it may have been probably on the edge of the box or something. One of them, he liked to score a few. Our team then, Friedling goal, back four, Young, Davis, Larson, Shorey, midfield, Barry Young, Petrov, Rio Coca, Agbonlahor, Carew up top. And then off the bench came James Milner, Carlos Cuellar, and one and only Craig Gardner.
Oof, what a team.
What a great team that was. I mean, you look at the West Brom team back then. They had Carson, Leon Barnett, Jonas Olsen, Paul Robinson, Gianni Zuvaloon, Chris Brunt, Jonathan Greening, Robert Corrin, James Morrison, Borja Valero and Roman Bednar.
Yeah, well, it wasn't a team full of big names, was it? Let's be honest.
Yeah,
I barely remember half of them.
I look at that and that is a shit lineup. No wonder we beat them.
Yeah.
But yeah, we'll see. I think part of me feels it's going to be another 0-0. But yeah, part of me feels we'll get a 1-0 win. I mean, my prediction for the Burnley game was 4-0, and obviously I was very wrong in that.
You were probably right in terms of XG and how that would have translated. You can't have been too
bad. It could have been.
I tell you what, I'm gonna take my 2-0 back. I think our bad luck over the course of Brighton, West Ham, Southampton, and now obviously in the last game, I'm gonna say we're gonna beat 4-0. We're finally gonna have some luck and we're gonna hammer them. There we go.
Well, do you know what? That would be, we deserve some luck, as you've said, because you look just last night, you know, Hawes header off the post. You look at, there was that one that took a couple of deflections. I think hit Watkins, could have gone anywhere. Obviously, you know, Matt Loughton's on the bloody post to clear it.
Yeah.
You look at, there was a few chances last night, you know, it's obviously a great save from Pope to tip El Ghazi's free kick onto the post. Traore, I think there was a chance from Traore where he took a couple of touches, and in that time, me and Tarkowski got back. There was a chance where Watkins did the same, where we tried to move it from his left onto his right to get a better shot at it. You know, you see a lot of the times, I mean, in all fairness, you look at the goal that Watkins scored against Liverpool, he's come onto his right and he's put it top corner. Sometimes you need that bit of luck just to be able to just get that touch in the right place before finishing it. And like you're saying, a lot of those games, you know, if you watch the Brighton and Southampton games, you know, the chances we had were ridiculous.
I posted it on one of the Facebook groups yesterday, actually, a compilation done by Understat on what the table should look like now if you went off expected points. We'd be in fourth place with two games in hand. Yeah, and based on our performances, that's roughly where you'd expect us to be. We've been so unlucky. Like, the amount of rockets that have flown into the top corner, and the amount of times we've either hit the post or had goals disallowed or had someone block it on the line or God knows what. The luck will change. And I'm really hoping, just for the poetic justice of it happening, firstly, to Sam Allardyce, and secondly, for it happening to a team who sacked a manager completely unjustly, that it really turns around this weekend.
Yep. Fingers crossed. Well, we'll see. But we will discuss that, and hopefully Sam Allardyce gets what he's given to him. Hopefully that's going to be a 4-0 Villa win. We'll discuss that Sunday after the game. Massive thanks to Ian, who's gone. He had to go somewhere. He hasn't got his priorities in order. And a massive thanks to Joe. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, as always. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Nice one. We've been here together, and we'll speak soon, Sunday after the West Brom game. Hopefully we'll get 3 points. Thanks very much for listening. Everyone who's listening along, make sure that if you're watching on YouTube, you subscribe. We're on Twitter and Instagram at Villa Together. Email us villatogether@gmail.com. I see Villa Together on YouTube. Make sure you hit the subscribe button. Helps the channel grow massively. Those of you watching on YouTube, you can see it scrolling along the bottom. Got some big guests coming up over the next few months, so make sure you subscribe so you get notifications about that. But a massive thank you, everyone who has subscribed so far and who is listening. You keep us going. So thank you very much. We've been Villa Together. Thank you.